there are tough decisions to be made for the good of the business, then you as a tool of the business should make those decisions. I think a lot of CEOs shy away from that who've been through an entrepreneurial journey because they're very loyal to their early team. But one of the big challenges of that kind of scaling is making the right decisions about people as often as you can. All businesses are people businesses, so I think it starts from there.
Guided by over 25 years in the data and research industry and assisting innovators with investment banking and advisory services, Sima Vasa brings you Data Gurus, a leading market research podcast that offers actionable insights for business acceleration and value creation. Join her as she speaks with key innovators in the space to bring you up to speed with the current state and the future of data analytics and data ecosystems. This is Data Gurus. Need support on your market research projects? Paradigm Sample is a full-service market research solutions provider. Whether you need help with questionnaire design, survey programming, or online data collection, we are ready to assist. Paradigm can do as little or as much as you need, saving you time so that you can focus on insights. Learn more at paradigmsample.com.
Welcome to another episode of Data Gurus. I'm excited to have Chris Harbiman, who is the CEO of RealityMine. Welcome, Chris.
Thanks, Sima. Great to be here.
Thank you. I appreciate you taking the time. I know winding down and getting ready for the holidays, it's a busy time. So thank you so much for spending a little bit of time talking to me.
Yeah, not at all. My pleasure.
So Chris, we have lots to talk about, but I always like to give my listeners a view of a personal journey. Like, how did you actually get to be where you are today? And I think it's always wonderful to realize that people's paths aren't always necessarily linear, but sometimes wavy and up and down. And you have a fascinating story. So I'd love if you could just share a little bit about your career progression.
Sure, very happy to. Very briefly, I suppose. I'm 56 now, so getting on a bit, but I'll try and cut this down to 2 or 3 minutes than the 35-year version or whatever it is. No, I had an early corporate career, and then I did an MBA in the end of the 90s at London Business School and worked for a while as a strategy consultant. But change was in the air, if you think about the kind of dot-com era. And I ended up doing a startup with a guy called Andrew Cooper, who runs a business called Verve. And Andrew and I founded a mobile phone advertising business in 2000 that we called the Mobile Channel. And the Mobile Channel had a slow and painful 3 years and then pivoted, as we fashionably say now, when your first plan's not working, into a business called Research Now. And we turned effectively an advertising audience that we developed, about 250,000 people in the UK, into an online research panel. And I think the story of the online research panel world is well known, probably well known to a lot of your viewers and listeners. But Research Now became one of the fast growth players in that market, very quickly spanned Europe, went into North America, then was acquired by eRewards, which was a US, largely US domestic player, a little bit bigger than us. And I became CEO of the combined business running eRewards combined with Research Now out of Dallas, Texas. I did that for a couple of years, went through the integration. So that was an 11-year journey over which by the time I left, we'd taken Research Now to about a $240 million business, 1,200 people. So from a startup, that felt a good journey. Maybe we'll talk about survey data and panels a bit later. I then took a year off. I was exhausted living on planes and all that kind of stuff. And took a year off, literally went to the beach, both physically and metaphorically. Learned to sail and all sorts of nice things. Then I wanted to do something completely different. And I bumped into a VC called Frog Capital. They had a business Rated People in their portfolio, which in the States, you'd be more familiar with Angie's List or Home Advisor. So one of the digital businesses helping you find a tradesperson to do home maintenance and repairs. Anyway, I'd succeeded the founder there. Did that for a couple of years. One reason or another, decided to move on again. And then did a number of things, actually. But one of them was I joined the board of this company, RealityMine, originally as a non-executive director and an angel investor. And then one thing led to another, and I ended up succeeding the two founders as CEO in 2018. So for the last 5 years, I've been CEO of RealityMine. And the reason I was interested in the business was, you know, we play in the space of behavioral data, which following my early insight career in survey data, seemed a kind of natural evolution of the journey. So I'm a third time CEO now. Yeah.
Just, I had two questions regarding your journey. Number one, those first 3 years when you started the mobile channel, I might have got my name wrong.
Yeah, no, that's right.
How did it feel? Like you weren't 100% sure if it was going to work. And as you rightfully said, you pivoted. But can you describe those kind of first 3 years a little bit?
Yeah, I guess it's what every entrepreneur goes through, or many entrepreneurs go through. We did the sort of stupid thing, you might argue, which was we quit well-paid jobs, the two of us, myself and Andrew, with no idea what we were going to do, no business plan, not really any money behind us. We just said, we're going to make it happen. And we were kind of both interested in marketing, and mobile was a big thing, still is a big thing, but was emerging, particularly in Europe with the 3G auctions. And the idea of mobile data services and mobile internet was really this new thing that everyone was talking about. So we thought, okay, this is going to be an interesting business idea to think about permission-based, incentive-based advertising on mobile devices, which ironically is where the eRewards business started. It started as a permission-based, reward-based advertising business, and then also pivoted, as it turns out. But we managed to raise an angel round in 2001, which, for those that remember, after 9/11 and so on, and after the dot-com crash, was an extremely tough time to raise any kind of capital. But we did. We raised a little venture round in 2002. We ran through that money with hindsight too quickly, although at the time, I didn't think we thought we were burning that much money, but we burned through the money. And then we did, now I think we can laughingly say, was the last rights of the mobile channel, which is a play on words, obviously, last rights being the possible death of the company, or the last rights issue, where existing shareholders would put in a little bit more money. And so in 2003, you could buy half of what became Research Now for £125,000.
Wow.
When it was sold to eRewards, only 6 years later, it was sold for $133 million.
That's amazing. That's a great story.
But it was tough. It was tough. We went unpaid for several years. We were struggling to make the business model work. All the classic stuff. And we came really close to giving up. But we didn't. A little bit of a pep talk from our chairman.
And then it sounds like in your career, you have always moved into that CEO spot, whether you were on the board and then moved into a CEO spot through the acquisition of Research Now and then became the CEO of a combined entity. Do you have any kind of specific tips or specific things that you hold dear to you in the role of CEO? That's a hard scale, right? From going from a startup to then selling the company to then managing a very large global company.
Yeah. I think the biggest thing is it's contextual. So leadership is contextual. The skills you need to bring to the table in one situation, not the skills you need to bring in another situation. As you say, it might be the scale of the company, might be the geography, it might be the cultural perspective at the time, the state of the business. If you're in a semi-crisis state versus boom time state, there are different things you need. And I think you've got to remember that. Another tip is, I think you should always think about what the business needs, not what about you need. Yeah, this kind of servant leadership. I always thought that it's not about me, it's about the business. And I try and hold on to that idea. And that means, for example, if there are tough decisions to be made for the good of the business, then you as a tool of the business should make those decisions. And I think a lot of CEOs shy away from that who've been through an entrepreneurial journey because they're very loyal to their early team. But one of the big challenges of that kind of scaling is making the right decisions about people as often as you can. All businesses are people businesses. So I think it starts from there.
So true. That's great advice. Let's talk about Reality Bind. Talk to us just a little bit more detail in terms of the company's purpose, what its focus, and how essentially do you serve clients?
Yeah. Okay. The tagline of the company is real life revealed. And so the idea is that ad technology reveals real life. Now, what does that mean? Our core product, those in the insight world would know it as passive metering technology. So it's software that is entirely permission-based. So a market research panelist may opt in to have our software deployed on one of their devices, and then it captures behavioral data. So it captures data about what websites they're visiting, what apps they're using, in-app data. We do a lot of work in the media space. So when I say in-app data, for example, you're watching season 2, episode 3 of such and such a show, we capture that data. The primary use case in our business is market research measurement. So as you will know better than me, Seema, when we think about the market research world, certainly of old, rough put very simply, half the industry was measurement, measuring what media people are consuming, whether that's TV or radio or print or whatever. The other half was working out why. Why are people doing what they're doing? Will they buy my product? Why aren't they buying my product? How should I price my product? All that stuff. And so we play fairly and squarely in the measurement side of that for the most part. So extending the measurement of what people are watching beyond, for example, television screens and onto mobile phones, tablets, laptops, that kind of stuff.
And when you think about the role of the, what you measure, the measurement is really through anything that happens through a mobile device. And I would imagine that portion is growing, right? When you think,
oh, for sure. If you've seen any stats recently about, I was at a conference, ASI, a few weeks ago in Nice, and a guy called Anthony Dobson gave a great talk about the use of TikTok in Southeast Asia, saying that some of these kids are spending 6-7 hours a day on TikTok. If you think about it, the way people are living their lives, hence Real Life Revealed, has extended probably too much, a lot of us would say, onto mobile devices. And in terms of whether you're shopping, how you're communicating, forming political opinions, consuming media, entertaining yourself, gaming, whatever. So yeah, so as human behavior has moved towards these devices, then those of us in the insights industry obviously need to move with the consumer to understand, A, what are they doing? And then also, why are they doing it?
And what is the value to a panelist to participate in this type of measurement?
Yeah.
I'd like to think they're fully aware, but you tell me in terms of...
I think we're pretty strong on that. I think because of the nature of the kind of data we collect, although we're based in the UK, I should have explained, maybe my accent might give that away, I don't know. But we operate globally. We operate a lot in the States, Japan, Singapore, Australia, you name it. And we apply GDPR worldwide, essentially that high bar of privacy. So a panelist needs to know what data is being collected, how it's being processed, how it's being stored, who has it, what it's being used for, all that stuff. So we do believe in and apply that. Back to your question, a lot of incentivized panels in audience measurement are how we go to market with the technology. So panelists earn incentives. But unlike survey research, they don't have to do anything. Once the software is installed, they just have to behave normally. And I think very quickly they do behave normally. There are some models, for example, our technology is in the M4 panel in the United States, the Surveys on the Go app. And one thing M4 does is they can do behavioral-based targeting for survey research. So based on someone's actual behavior, I can survey you knowing you've done something. Maybe you've got a certain website or you've used a certain app. And so I can send you more relevant surveys. The incentive model can be skewed to the relevance and value of the surveys as distinct from capturing the behavioral data itself.
Got it. And I think it's important to know your company focuses so much on that privacy, the recruitment of getting people to install the app, collect the data. But where do you stop in that value chain in terms of collection of data, analysis, results, reporting, impact?
Yeah. So we're a technology and data provider, not an out-and-out insights business today. And I think there are some kind of evolution of the business in the works. But for the most part, we go to market through partners, through channels. The primary one is the large market research global players. And you'll see their logos on our website and in our case studies and so on. And through specialist partners as well. So I mentioned Anthony Dobson at AMPD Research. They work for the streaming company specifically and provide a kind of competitive intelligence product about who's watching, what kind of content is helping retain people on a streaming platform, for example. But our job is to effectively collect the data, process it into a usable form for our clients, and then they do the kind of lifting in terms of how do I turn that into insight for a segment.
That makes a lot of sense. I think more and more as issues related to privacy and consumer experience, there is a real, and knowing the nuances by each country, there is a competency there that is needed, and it's very difficult. I'm seeing more and more players that focus on that part of the value chain, because if there's any kind of, even through M&A, if there's any concern around breakage and privacy or any foul play, if you will, nobody's going to touch it in this day and age. Not that they touched it before, but because of the relevance of adhering to consumer privacy is so great now, it really takes a lot of time and attention and not to split out functional expertise.
Yeah. And I think to be fair, the market research or the insights industry has been over the years pretty good at that. You compare our sector, for example, to the ad tech sector, and you'd have to say, we're pretty good at it. I still read the same old articles I was reading 20 years ago about better respondent experience for surveys and how we need to treat them better. And it's really 20 years later, we're still having the debate. But
I know. That's another topic. And it's just, I think for a lot of us, we want to just put our heads down and say, I hope this improves. But the reality is, we're all culprits of it in terms of how many surveys have we taken and I abandoned because I'm like, this is way too long. I'm not going to do this. So yeah, we do it to ourselves sometimes, I think.
For sure. I think there's a new breed of the kind of mobile, short, sharp.
Yes.
I think it's very powerful. And of course, with tools like AI coming at us fast now, how people are able to analyze less data to get more is an interesting question. That's a whole nother podcast as well.
Yeah. No, but we're going to get to AI. I would be remiss if I don't ask you about AI on this conversation. But I agree with you. I mean, you're right. Not to be doom and gloom, the short, frequent surveys are definitely taking hold. And I think consumers, especially younger people, like those quick, easy hits and honestly rewards, right? That value equation seems to have a lot of value for people. I'm curious from your perspective, and this might not be a fair question since you're not doing the full analysis of the data, but what are some surprising trends that you've seen as it relates to consumer behavior in terms of consumption of content or apps, or you mentioned TikTok? Any kind of surprising findings that you're like, oh man, I guess I knew that, or that's really a novel finding here?
Yeah, I think actually what you see when you actually look at the behavioral data is often what is intuitive. And I think compared to survey data, people talk about this kind of say-do gap. And I think the same is true of, take political polling, and will people vote for Trump or will they vote for Boris Johnson or whatever? And often there was an understated vote. And I think the same is true of behavioral data, that actually people say, sure, I use social media a little bit. But if you actually contrast how much they're actually spending, the time they're spending on their phones and what they're doing, it's pretty stark and just hits you how we really are living our lives through these devices. I personally, I've even turned off the screen time function on Apple that tells you how much you use your Mac and your iPad. I've turned it off. I don't want to know.
You don't want to know anymore.
Bury my head in the sand. but I think what also is maybe not surprising is the kind of things people browse on the web. You know, people, there's this question of, if you're being incentivized and your behavior is being captured for insight, will people behave normally? I think people behave normally. People carry on doing what they were doing before.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember the early days of Media Metrics when I was at MPD. They do behave normally, but just looking at the top sites that were being browsed on a frequent basis. So I guess that's good for research. We're not predicting behavior through incentivization. Let's talk about AI and your thoughts around how it could impact our industry. It's already playing a role in the industry, obviously. It plays a role in society, but everybody talks about, there's probably three multiple camps, but one is like this existential threat of AI. And the other one is, how do we leverage technology such as AI to continue to enhance insights that we provide clients? I would love to get your perspective. And obviously, I toggle between both, but I'm curious what your thoughts are.
I'm definitely in that second camp. I think just looking at RealityMind and ourselves, you know, we're actually about to announce, so you're hearing this hot off the press, the appointment of our kind of chief AI officer. So maybe it's fashionable or maybe it's the right thing to do, but we think it's the right thing to do. And the reason is, we think it's really important. For us, we see opportunities in the kind of product development. So we're capturing huge amounts of very complicated data off digital devices. And so making sense of that, AI has a role to play in kind of that product development process. I think we also see areas of productivity where you can just see the kind of heavy lifting that the AI can do, including code development by software engineers who can just pick up, a bit like you can use ChatGPT to ask you to write a job description. The software developer can do the same thing for a piece of code and get 80% of the way there. So I think productivity is part of it. I think the thing that I'm thinking about more than that as such is, yes, but AI shouldn't just be about making us better and more effective and faster. Is it a threat to our entire position in the insights value chain? Could we be trumped at a higher order of magnitude, as it were? I think that's a question that, I think the answer is no, but I think everyone should be thinking like that. How existential could this be? I've read a lot of these articles that I'm sure you have around synthetic data and the fact that, do we need human respondents to any great extent? And I'm sure that if you're sitting on a library of survey results for years, where you've been able to also measure outcomes. So maybe that relates to, I don't know, ad effectiveness of a piece of ad copy. And if you've got that library of what the respondents said and how the ad performed and all the contextual data, what was the media, blah, blah, blah. I'm sure the model can give you a pretty good substitute, possibly a superior substitute for a fresh survey. But I do think that it's obvious that over time, as things like fashion change, I think at the margin, you will need the real humans. But probably to improve the model, as distinct from to go back to the well and get square one survey data from scratch. So I think we're going to move to a world of iteration and evolution. It always used to annoy me how inefficient the online panel industry was. We'd run a survey for one client 1 week about, I don't know, console gaming. And then 2 weeks later, we'd be running a similar survey, which had 75% overlap in terms of what was being asked on and of whom. And yet the two data sets never intersected or interacted in any way.
Right. Well, and I think also the art of the industry is in that questionnaire writing, right? We pride ourselves in saying, whoever wrote the questionnaire owns that data. And hence, there's no overlap. But I think the shift of the companies that have the consumers who fill out these surveys, there could be a shift to say, look, we need to improve our salon and experience. So we're not going to ask the same survey. We're going to own this data and share it back with you. Radical, but that truly is improving respondent experience.
Yeah. And I think the value will therefore shift to, rather than the kind of pilot high, sell it cheap model that we've seen too much of, it'll move, it'll be a flight to quality. And I think that quality will be able to charge fair value for what it's able to uniquely do or do with competitive advantage over others. So I think it's time that anyone in that respondent data collection world got their strategies together and thought about that. I think they are.
100%. I think you can't not be thinking about it and developing strategies. I think to the point of this is true scenario planning in terms of understanding which one do I plan for? And maybe in the past, there were 3 scenarios. Maybe in the future, there might be 5. And then what are the signals that indicate which scenario do you... Easier said than done, but I know there are lots of conversations around that. And the conversation around, do you need people to fuel the industry? So it'll be interesting. I don't know. I keep thinking, obviously, synthetic data will play a role in the industry, just like everything else as things come in, like mobile, blockchain made an imprint on the industry. I do think that synthetic data will make an impact on the industry. And there's also complementary roles or use cases for real respondents in terms of where we leverage them and how we leverage them. And it'll keep us on our toes to make sure we treat those respondents well and they continue to stay with us.
And I think an exciting thing as well is how now can we combine different forms of data in ways that researchers have been trying to do for a long time, but using AI. So to take that high quality survey data, but to integrate it with other forms of data that the enterprise may have. And we would say from Radman's perspective, of course, including behavioral data. But I think that's been challenging. I think a lot of people have stuck to tried and tested methodologies, and the AI tools may see us leapfrog to finding insights, but not really understanding how the model is doing it for the first time, which is a bit of a scary thought.
It is. And I also think what you just alluded to, or you stated directly, is that the insights providers and everybody on the value chain obviously is going to be impacted, but also on the client side, the silos of who owns what data, those walls can break down rightfully to be able to join these different data sets together and provide a higher level of value to clients. And the sales data sits in one part of the organization, finance data, another part of the organization, but truly over time, as we join all of that, it could be a step function change.
For sure. And I think you could argue that for sure that data integration within the enterprise, the kind of chief data officer layer, is an absolutely critical enabler of the possibility of AI. If you don't have your data together, you have a problem.
That's a building block, right? For the next step of being able to utilize AI and see the real value of it. Chris, talk to me about what you think the future of advertising looks like.
Wow, that's a big question.
We still keep quoting 50% of all ad dollars are wasted, right? And continue to hear that over and over again. I'd like to think that we're improving and there's more value and hence it's not that much quote unquote waste, but as there's a lot of bots and fraud and everything else, but curious your perspective on, are we on this journey of advertising dollars and attribution?
Yeah, I know it's, and I can't claim to be a huge expert in the advertising industry by any means. I'm a data person for the insight world, but I think if you just look at media and you look at recent trends, the last 5 to 10 years, the big trend that you see is the ad dollars moving to the walled gardens. The big tech giants, Alphabet, Meta, and so on, hoovering up the dollars, and all the growth in the industry has been taken.
And they own the data too.
And they own the data. And they own some of the media. And I think a lot of people talk about consolidation in, for example, the streaming marketplace, where only a couple of years ago, it was boom time and we were a golden age of content. And now everyone's looking at the bottom line and talking about consolidation. And many of those potential consolidators are the tech giants, because they're the only people that can both afford and leverage those assets effectively. So I think things like, you know, ad-supported tiers in streaming, which are taking hold, some places quicker and some places slower, will continue to accelerate. And I think, barring major sort of antitrust moves that, of course, take glacial time to play out, I think you can continue to see those ad dollars moving more and more towards walled gardens. And I think that's obvious when you think about markets like the US and are well known, but we operate in a lot of other markets like India, and you see the same kind of trends. Digital players like YouTube with massive market positions, new movers in India like Jio, buying up things like the Indian Premier League cricket rights. But I think one of the things that's fascinating is the rules of media are changing. The big players aren't playing by the old media rules, where for the most part, your revenue streams were advertising, right? But now if you're Apple or you're Amazon, you might think quite differently about your economic drivers to want to control and own a lot of media. So it's a very confusing picture, actually. I think giving good predictions a few years out as to how it plays out, very difficult, I would say. But I think one thing I would bet on is even greater concentration of power over media in the hands of the established tech giants.
It's scary when you think about it, how much power that the tech companies have, not just in media, but impacting political views and shaping kind of societal norms and perspectives. But yeah, anyway, it is the reality of the world we live in.
At the same time, we all love the, you should see our Christmas lists here for the holidays. We have a lot of Apple gadgets under the tree.
Right. So. You're right. We're not rejecting it. We're consuming it. And also there's positive stories too, in terms of being able to help others, like not necessarily in your local community, but globally. Or yeah, so I don't mean to sound like it's all bad. There's definitely good use cases of leveraging social media and different technology platforms for sure. It's just about, sometimes I feel like we manage to the lowest common denominator, and that's difficult. And so how do you raise the floor a bit in terms of what's acceptable? And then you get into whole free speech stuff and everything else. But
it is the point though, isn't it? It's the challenge of our age that we were just talking briefly about AI, which is the supposed fastest yet growth curve in terms of adoption, now that the sort of UI is there with ChatGPT and so on. But we live in an age where societies, human beings, families can't keep pace with the rate of change being thrown at us by technology. We will get there. I'm an optimist, so I think we will get there. But the kind of catch-up phase that we're in, how best to use a lot of this technology, or how best to regulate a lot of this technology.
Yes, I know. The R word is hard to say, but yes, agreed. Regulation, that is. But I do think...
But that could be by a family. That could be a family regulation saying rules like no phones at dinner, for example. That's regulation.
You're so right. It's self-regulation too, right? It could be family regulation. It could be community regulation. You're absolutely right. So the ability for us to, as individuals, regulate ourselves and the uses of technology will be critically important. And we see it with kids, right? That's the place that I think is the biggest impact, where it probably is more required than anywhere else, because their brains are still forming, although my brain's still forming too. So I love to keep learning. Chris, thank you so much for joining me. I thoroughly enjoyed our conversation. I look forward to keeping in touch.
Sounds good.
Thank you for listening to the Data Gurus podcast, brought to you by Infinity Squared. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a 5-star review and be sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode. Tired of market research solutions that put your project in a box? At Paradigm Sample, we approach market research support with customized and consultative solutions. Whether you need help with questionnaire design, survey programming, or online data collection, we're ready to assist. Let us know your needs, and we can customize a solution just for you. Learn more at ParadigmSample.com.